At the same instant I felt a shock in my right hand and a stinging sensation in my index finger. The boys were startled. Al yelled, "What happened, Angie?" I didn't reply, but held out my index finger for all of them to see. Five of them watched as a round welt appeared on my finger. The welt was not red like a burn, but appeared gray. It was about the size of a dime, a perfectly round circle with a dark dot in the center, again the symbol of the hydrogen atom. Somebody said something about static electricity, but all of them were deeply puzzled, or nothing like that had ever happened before. Al advised me to get medical attention at the plant hospital. I told him it would not be necessary, there was no pain whatsoever. L. I reminded him that the same thing had happened to me in the saucer when I had received a considerably larger similar mark on my left side below the heart. They laughed at my explanation and refused to believe that extraterrestrials had anything to do with the sudden unaccountable phenomenon which had produced the strange mark on my finger. Yet they were mystified, and today any one of them will testify to the authenticity of the experience. The odd mark remained on my index finger for some months as a constant reminder of the proximity of unseen visitors. The latter part of October, Maid made a trip back to New Jersey to visit our folks. When she returned several weeks later, my mother and father accompanied her, as they wanted to spend a month or two in California. Mabel wired me to meet them at the Greyhound bus depot. I was eager to see Mabel again and looking forward to a reunion with my dad and mother. I drove downtown the night they were to arrive, as thrilled as a kid. It was around 6 o'clock and the streets heavy with traffic parking my car. I walked toward the bus terminal. It too was bustling with activity. In all of the excitement, flying saucers and space visitors were the farthest things from my mind. But as I entered the front door of the bus terminal, I stopped in my tracks and stared, unable to believe my eyes. Directly in front of me and facing the newsstand was a familiar face. I knew I couldn't be mistaken, it was Neptune. He glanced up and his dark eyes told me that he was expecting me. He was dressed in an ordinary dark business suit and carried a briefcase under his arm. A dark blue felt hat with snap brim shaded his eyes. And he appeared as real as any person in the depot. After the sudden shock of surprise, I started forward to greet him, but a strong telepathic command stopped me. I stood hesitant looking at him. He stood up, facing me, and I could not help noticing how tall, extremely handsome and distinguished he appeared in the hurrying throngs of people. He was not smiling, in fact, his face was almost stern as though he might be angry. I wondered what I had done wrong. I completely forgot Mabel and the folks waiting for me. His intent gaze never left me. Stalling for time, I walked over to the newsstand and picked up a magazine and thumbed through it. I had received the definite telepathic impression not to approach him, thus I waited for him to speak to me. But he did not. Staring blankly at a page in the magazine, I waited for further telepathic communication. It came. The gist of the message was, "The last time you saw me, Orfeo, I was in a less objectified projection in your three-dimensional world. The purpose being to give you some idea of our true aspect. But now tonight you see me fully objectified. If you did not know who I am, you could not tell me from one of your fellows. Tonight I am no half-phantom, but can move among men as an Earthman. It is not necessary for you to speak to me, you have gained the understanding. You know now that we can appear and function as human beings." I looked gratefully into his eyes, and as in my previous encounter with him, I felt again a unity of being, as though I were momentarily released from the bonds of individuality. Just then Mabel and the folks spied me. As in a dream, I heard them call to me as they came rushing over to me. Like an automaton, I kissed Mabel and hugged Mom and Pop. All the while they were talking and holding my hands. I was going through the motions of greeting them, but I was still so stunned that I scarcely knew what was happening. Together we all walked towards the exit, and I noticed that Neptune was following a short distance behind us. When we reached the door, I was about to open it when Neptune reached out and pushed it open for us. I was more astounded than ever, for it meant that he could function in the physical world as easily as any Earthling. Outside he walked a few places to the left and stopped. There he opened his briefcase and removed a pack of cigarettes. He removed a cigarette from the pack and put the package back in the briefcase. Then, without lighting the cigarette, he tossed it into the gutter. I was smoking a cigarette too. Following Neptune's action, I tossed my cigarette away. Mabel noticed my preoccupation and odd behavior. She looked at Neptune and then at me and asked, "Who is that man and why is he staring at us so intently?" I didn't reply to her question as I was too confused to get involved in explanations. I said, "Come on, May, let's get the suitcases into the car." She knew something was wrong and I was aware of the three faces studying me with perplexity. I made fumbling excuses for my odd behavior. But on the drive home I was able to begin to snap out of it and to show them the warm welcome I felt in my heart. Chapter 5 The Past Is Never Dead. The Christmas holidays arrived with their gay, festive spirit and usual bustling excitement. By then things had settled back to normal and I had experienced no further contacts. Flying saucers seemed to have vanished from the skies, practically no accounts of sightings appeared in the newspapers. Although I had completed the manuscript for the 20th Century Times, I couldn't get up the courage to have it published. Mabel kept saying, "Orphie, if you publish that, people will think you are completely crazy. Why don't you just forget it? Nothing good can ever come of it. Everything is going along so smoothly now, we're both working and the boys are happy, let's just leave it that way." "But, May," I'd remonstrate. "Don't you understand? These things really happened to me. It is my duty to tell what I know. And just what thanks will you get for it? Do you want to be ridiculed, laughed at and considered a crackpot or a psycho? Think back. Remember how everybody talked when you first told that wild story about a trip in a flying saucer. What did it get you but ridicule? Even if it did happen, Orphie, forget it. Just forget the whole thing for your family's sake. Let's be happy and enjoy life." Thus, although I felt I was betraying Neptune, I let things drift and made no effort to get my story published. In fact, on New Year's Day, 1953, our lives were going along so smoothly and pleasantly that I had decided to forget it all insofar as the world was concerned and let those incredible experiences become a part of the dead past of 1952. But the events of 1952 would not rest. During the latter part of January, 1953, the front pages of the newspapers were carrying sensational news saucer stories. The Air Force released reports that flying discs and strange clusters of lights were numerous over Korea. F-94 Starfires had encountered several of the saucers and one of their pilots had gotten a radar magnet o'clock on one of them. Northern Japan too had many sightings. The reports made me restless. At night I frequently went outside and scanned the heavens. Frequently I saw the discs overhead as roving lights. Any casual observer would not give a second glance, but simply pass the lights off as ordinary airplane lights. And since our apartment was close to several large airports, there were usually airplanes visible at all times. I should never have been able to distinguish saucer lights from those of aircraft were it not for the peculiar sensitivity of my nervous system to the electromagnetic effect of the saucers. Then I began to be ashamed of myself for having failed so completely the trust that Neptune had placed in me. He had said, "The road will open, Orpheo, travel it as you will." I realized that thus far I had refused to travel the road and except for the few talks I had made to small groups I had done nothing to help people understand the strange visitors. More and more every day I realized how selfish I was in thinking first of my family and myself. Finally I knew there was no alternative for me. Come what may, I had to go ahead with publication of the facts of my experiences. It was the only constructive thing I could think of to do. Without discussing the matter any further with Mabel, I took the manuscript for the 20th Century Times to several local publishers. None of them were encouraging. Far from it. The first one I approached was highly amused and a little contemptuous as he said, "You'd better send this thing to a science fiction mag, old boy, unless you want to land in a straitjacket. The next publisher I tried told me how rambling and incoherently the thing was written. You forget I'm not a writer, I replied. I've done the best I can and all of the facts are there. He laughed. You say the facts are here, but are they? You start off by saying these experiences are true and yet before the narrative is completed you have inferred several times that they could be imaginary. In fact, right here on the front page you make the statement, this story is either a yarn or it is real. What kind of facts are those? And how can you expect people to accept the paper as actual fact? I've thought of all that, I replied. Frankly, it was my idea to break the news gently. In other words, to let the readers feel uncertain at first as to the absolute authenticity of the facts. To tell this entire thing at first as fact is too much of a shock for an unstable world. As you yourself say, I might be hustled off to a mental institution. Let the truth of what I have to say develop gradually. After considerably more talk along these same lines, he agreed to publish it. But only as I would permit him to edit it and delete major portions of the story. I flatly refused and he in turn refused to have anything to do with publication of the manuscript. And so it went. I tried publisher after publisher with the same discouraging results. At last, however, I found a small publishing house that was willing to print the piece word for word as written if I would pay all publishing costs and take all of the papers myself. I agreed to do this. But as we parted he shook his head and said, pardon me for saying this, Mr. Angelucci, but I honestly think you are making a grave mistake. Not only are you throwing your money away, but you are liable to make yourself a public laughing stock. I'll have to risk all that, I answered. There is no alternative for me, I must publish that paper. Thus on February 19, 1953, the one and only issue of the 20th Century Times came off the press, an 8-page, tabloid-type newspaper which carried word for word an account of all my experiences I felt it was wise for me to release. I breathed a huge sigh of relief when I saw the paper, for I felt that I had satisfied a debt. When I walked into our apartment with an armful of the papers, Mabel took one horrified look at one of the sheets and sank down in a chair. Oh, Orphy, you didn't do it. You didn't. This thing is dynamite. It can wreck us. Wreck your job, my job and the boys' schooling. This can finish everything we've built up here. I'm sorry, May, I replied doggedly. Believe me, there is no other way out for me. I've got to live with myself, so I had to do it. I hope you'll try to understand. But I knew May didn't understand. And as copies of the paper got around, many of her predicted reactions occurred. People began ridiculing me outright and several papers published sarcastic news items about me and my experiences, subtly inferring that I wasn't all there. Believe me, it wasn't easy to bear, and especially did I suffer for my family. The boys were ripped unmercifully at school and at her job at the snack bar. Mabel was the constant target for the sharp barbs of wit aimed at me. But the response was not entirely negative. Some persons became genuinely interested. About that time I resumed my weekly talks at the clubhouse and thus I was able to distribute the papers at the meetings. As more and more persons became interested and ceased to take my 20th Century Times as a joke, I began to feel that all might not be lost. And more important, I could face my reflection in the mirror again. Happy in the thought that I had not entirely failed the space visitors. Chapter 6, Airplanes to Disappear. Not long after my publication of the paper a new aspect of my experiences with the sources developed. On the afternoon of March 3, 1953 I was sitting alone in the kitchen, reading. I was dully aware of the steady drone of an airplane which continued for some time. The sound apparently was coming from the west. Gradually it dawned upon me that the sound was too steady and too unwavering for an ordinary aircraft. Curiously, I got up and looked out the door. Coming from the north I saw what appeared to be an ordinary small aluminum airplane. From where I was standing in the doorway there was nothing unusual in the sound of the craft as it assumed the normal crescendo of direct approach. I stepped out of doors and watched it fly directly overhead until it was fairly in the face of the sun, when suddenly and astoundingly the plane was no longer there. Just as mysteriously the sound of its motor ceased abruptly too. I never saw the plane again. Confused, I went back into the house. Obviously, the craft was not a flying disc, but a conventional type aircraft, for I had not experienced any of the unpleasant physical symptoms that a flying disc invariably produces in my body. 4 days later, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was accompanying Jane Vandelick, a neighbor who is employed at the Los Feliz Theater Cafe. We were walking to the cafe where Jane was going to open it half an hour early that day. We were laughing and talking when Jane noticed an airplane nearby in the sky, flying south. It seemed just an ordinary airplane of the most common type, maybe that's a flying saucer, Orfeo. I thought she was kidding me and replied, "Not you too, Jane." But her eyes were serious. "I mean it, Orfeo. There's something peculiar about that airplane." For the first time I scrutinized the craft carefully. After a moment I had to admit there was something unusual about it. It appeared extremely dull and flat-surfaced and did not reflect any of the rays of the setting sun as it ordinarily should have done. While we were both staring at it, the airplane suddenly vanished right before our eyes in a clear and cloudless sky. The sound of its motor ceased just as abruptly. Both of us stood in our tracks. Jane stared at me. "What happened to that airplane, Orfeo?" I shook my head and then replied slowly, "I wasn't going to mention it to anyone, Jane, but I saw the same thing happen 4 days ago. I don't know what it means." We stood there for some minutes, our eyes vainly searching the skies for some trace of the vanished plane. I requested Jane to remember every detail of the strange incident. She promised that she would. "If you ask her about it today, she will verify the experience just as I have related it to you." Several days later, I was with a group of employees sitting around the Lockheed plant. It was about 5 minutes before 4 in the afternoon. We were waiting for the shifts to change preparatory to going on duty. My good friend, but most confirmed skeptic, Richard Butterfield, was with us. While we were talkingly, an apparently ordinary-to-engine airplane came into view over the hills. Butterfield's attention was attracted to the craft. He arose from the bench and stared up at it as though he was spellbound. His behavior reminded me immediately of Jane Vandelick's actions a few days previously. Her eyes had been attracted to that particular plane just as Butterfield's eyes were now drawn to this one. Yet neither of the planes had any effect upon me. The crowd all noticed Butterfield's deep absorption in the small plane. Some of them started laughing and began ribbing him. I remember someone shouting, "Look! He ain't never seen an airplane before." But Butterfield paid no attention. Finally, almost as though talking to himself, he said, "What is that?" Several voices helpfully jibed in with wisecracks about his being sorely in need of an optician's advice. One fellow remarked scathingly, "Any dope can see it's nothing but an ordinary-to-engine airplane." I didn't say anything, for I had noticed by then how flat-toned the craft was and how it failed to reflect the rays of the afternoon sun. Suddenly there was an instantaneous flash that appeared to envelop the plane. When the flash was over, there was no sign of a plane to be seen anywhere in the sky. The droning of its motors too had ceased. Many of the group had seen the phenomenon. They were startled and confused, and everyone started talking at once, trying to explain just what had happened. Others continued to stare into the skies, searching for the vanished plane. Butterfield dazedly brushed his hand across his eyes. It seemed difficult for him to come back to the norm of this world. He didn't say much, but for a long time after we had gone on the job, he appeared to be in deep thought. I didn't volunteer any explanations, for the sudden disappearance of the plane in a brilliant flash was a new development for me. I kept mulling it over in my mind, as well as the 2 previous experiences in which I had seen airplanes simply disappear into thin air. But I didn't give the incidents too much thought, as I had more than enough to do to try and unscramble the puzzle of my previous experiences with the extraterrestrials without adding more problems. Within a week, most of those who had seen the plane disappear had either forgotten the incident or had figured out some explanation that satisfied them. I saw then that the human mind does not want to believe anything it cannot understand. It will rationalize to any extent rather than face the unknown. As the weeks passed, I continued to be ribbed more and more. Some of my fellow workers were even inferring that I was lying just for cheap publicity. I would joyfully have dropped the whole thing like a red-hot coal, if I had not had the deep sense of loyalty and responsibility to those greater beings that neither I nor my fellows could begin to understand. As the situation became more unpleasant at the plant, I finally decided to turn in my notice, for by then my experiences were fairly well known throughout Southern California, and thus I was in for constant ridicule. I knew I'd either have to shut up about space visitors or else quit my job. I decided on the latter. My last 3 weeks at work were rather memorable. On August 14, Ernie Oxford and I were working on an airplane part outside the building. He, like all of the others when they got me alone, was harping on the space visitors and my wild story in that 20th century Times. He was contentiously declaring that neither he or his girlfriend could swallow such a story. I told him that it was his right to believe only what he wished to believe. Then I suggested that we forget the subject and concentrate on the job we had to do. But Ernie couldn't be stopped. He kept on telling me what a big mistake I was making. While he was berating me, I looked toward the Burbank Mountains, pictures, and there directly over a ridgetop was a flying saucer. I touched Ernie on the shoulder and pointed to the saucer. He dropped his tools and stared. Don Quinn, working nearby, saw us gazing into the sky and came running over. While we were watching the thing, it appeared suddenly to flip and vanished. Ernie kept asking, "Where did it go?" And after that experience he was quiet for a while. Then he began talking about the saucers and nothing else. He still didn't believe my story, but he knew he had actually seen a saucer. Friday, August 21st, at 9:15 in the evening. The entire shift was hard at work. My mind was preoccupied and I was busy on an airplane part. Suddenly a tremor passed over me. I knew it could mean only one thing. I put down my tools and walked to the huge door, which was open only about a foot. As I looked out into the night, I saw a light in the skies which appeared to be approaching the plant. While I watched, the light stopped in mid-air and changed from amber to red. There was no doubt in my mind about what it was. I called to some of the fellows in the plant and beckoned them to join me. A number of them hurried over and we pushed open the door and went outside. All who came were rewarded. Every one of the men saw the red disc hanging overhead in the sky. While they were staring, I glanced at their faces and I was deeply impressed with what I saw. Momentarily, they were like changed men. Wonder, awe, and belief were in their faces. Thus I was struck with the realization of what the mere sight of a single disc can do to the thinking of a number of persons. While I was watching their reactions, they all turned suddenly and looked questioningly at me. I glanced up into the sky to see that the disc had vanished and only the moon and the stars were overhead. I asked where the disc had gone and all of them started to tell me. From the many explanations, I learned that the saucer had appeared to move until it was directly below the moon, where it began to ascend. As it ascended, it changed in color from red to amber and then to the silvery color of the moon. As it climbed higher, its color became indistinguishable from the moon, so that they could not tell what actually happened to it. But it had vanished. All of that had happened while I was watching their faces. We trooped back into work and all of the men were quiet and thoughtful. At the 10-minute break, I told them that on the following night at the second break I was going to ask each one of them to tell his story of what he had seen. Every man told precisely the same story. In all there were 12 men. I failed somehow to get the names of two of the fellows, but here are the names of the other 9: Dave Donegan, Al Durand, Dave Remick, Michael Gallegos, Richard Becker, Richard McGinley, Bruce Bryan, Ernie Oxford and Louis Pasco. Every one of these men will affirm the details of this sighting. The phenomenon did not happen fast. They all had plenty of time to observe and impress details on their minds. All of them believed they had seen a flying saucer. Hence, I was enabled to leave my job with much of the stigma of untruth taken from the account of my experiences I had printed in all good faith in my 20th Century Times. Among those 12 men, there are two who are still deeply perplexed. They are Ernie Oxford and Michael Gallegos, for they had seen me drop my tools and go to the door as though beckoned by an unseen force. They said I behaved as though I were under a spell. Both of them started involuntarily to follow me, but on second thought remained on the job until I called them to come out. Both of them insist that I must have received a message of some kind from the disc. When I told them that it was only a physical reaction and a deep intuitive feeling that space visitors were near, they believed I was holding something back from them. For they said that for a moment they too had felt something indescribable. With that I agree fully, and I was happy that I was no longer alone. Friday, August 28th, was my last work night at Lockheed. I was outside working on an airplane part. That night Don Quinn was my partner. He was among those most skeptical of my saucer experiences, and like the others he always insisted upon talking about them when we were together. He was telling me what a big mistake I was making in giving up my job and getting myself generally ridiculed. But I was used to such talk, and let him talk on. I glanced up into the sky and saw a silvery disc moving southeastward along the mountain rim. I immediately called Don's attention to it. He dropped his tools and stared and immediately began demanding to know what it was. Why does it behave that way? How can it hang in the air like that? I didn't reply to any of his questions. Suddenly, it had just disappeared. Poor Don stared at me incredulous and bewildered. He admitted its flight characteristics were like nothing he had ever seen or heard of, yet he would not fully go along with the flying saucer explanation. Actually, he could not quite believe his own eyes. Thus seeing is not always believing. For I have seen other persons actually see a saucer and refuse to believe the evidence of their own sight. It was during August that many of the strange events included in this chapter occurred. I was also in August that a revealing press release came through International News Service, which recalled to my mind those cases of the airplanes which mysteriously vanished in thin air. The news item follows: planes seen over Arctic Washington, August 1, INS. An Air Force spokesman disclosed today that roughly 12 unidentified airplanes have penetrated the U.S. defense perimeter in the Arctic within the last year. The spokesman said that the invaders were not identified as Russian, so no protests could be made to Soviet authorities. Some of the planes were tracked on radar scopes, while others were seen to give off white vapor streaks. But before U.S. fighter pilots could give chase, they would mysteriously disappear out of radar range, the spokesman said. He asserted that the raiders crossed the edge of the U.S. radar perimeter in Greenland and Alaska, but added they also flew elsewhere over the North American continent. The Air Force has given pilots strict orders not to fire upon any unidentified plane unless a hostile act has been committed or is about to be, such as a bomber flying over U.S. territory with its bombay doors open. Could it be that those mysterious disappearing airplanes I had seen had penetrated the U.S. defense perimeter in the Arctic? On the following day, a counter-release came through International News Service. This counter-release negated all of the information given out in the first release. These contradictory reports followed an already definitely established pattern. Official news releases of a mystifying nature concerning the sources are invariably followed up by counter-releases or actual retractions of previous statements. As irritating and confusing as such contradictory reports are to the public, nevertheless, this method of handling UFO information by the authorities is best for everyone concerned. For with a little thought, it is clear that such mystifying news stories without an official damper placed upon them immediately might easily flare up into a nationwide inflagration of panic and hysteria. Official headquarters would be snowed under with avalanches of telegrams, letters, phone calls and personal inquiries. Thus only further confusion would result. The story of the extraterrestrials is one that no one can or will ever be able to finish with any degree of finality. It is my sincere personal belief that the Air Force and other responsible officers have responded to and handled the problems of space visitors precisely as those visitors have anticipated and desire them to do. As more and more thinking persons realize this significant fact, we will be prepared for greater revelations to come. Perhaps it would be well to state here that in the cases of disappearing aircraft, I do not believe the ships dematerialize or dissolve into nothingness, as it would appear. Being composed primarily of a crystalline substance, the ships may give the illusion of complete transparency or, if so controlled, they can be rendered entirely opaque. Thus, also, they can manifest any color or combination of colors, depending upon the energy employed and its control on the molecular substance of the crystal body. It is no problem for the crystal discs to project visual images of ordinary aircraft and similarly to produce the auditory vibrations of aircraft engines. These projections may be easily picked up on a radar screen. Chapter 7 Flying Saucer Convention in Hollywood. During those last days I was at Lockheed, I thought often of Neptune's cryptic words, "The road will open, Orpheo, walk it as you will," and later when he said, "I smile upon you, Orpheo, for your greatly enhanced numbers." Then his last prophetic words, "Strength and courage will be given to the millions who will rise and meet the great battles ahead with only a faint hope on their side for victory." It was true, I thought, the road was beginning to open. New understandings and an ever-increasing awareness were coming to me as time passed. Also, as more and more people learned of my experiences, many began to phone, write, or visit at our home, wishing to know more about the space visitors. We continued the regular meetings at the Los Felix Clubhouse, but as the crowds increased, the clubhouse was no longer large enough to accommodate everyone. It was then that Max Miller, president of the Flying Saucers International, an organization devoted to the study of flying saucer phenomena, and Jerome Criswell, the well-known columnist and television man of prophecy, suggested that we rent the music room in the famous old Hollywood Hotel for our weekly meetings. Thus we had been meeting there for several months every Sunday or afternoon. Opinions were exchanged and lectures on saucer phenomena were presented to enthusiastic audiences. Paradoxically enough, as the general public's interest in the saucers increased, the press, radio, television and other news media suddenly and inexplicably dropped flying saucers from the news. Even the second-rate science fiction writers banished the word from their lexicon of horrors. Thus the public was left to grope for itself. And surprisingly enough, the way was thus cleared for those individuals who had experienced actual contacts with the extraterrestrials to work freely without obstruction of erroneous slanting by official reporting. Gerald Hurd, Frank Scully and Donald Kehoe were familiar names among persons interested in the saucers.